Hey, Deserving listeners, we recently did an episode about Armie Hammer, and in that episode, me and Umberto were debating to some extent, and we've had this debate before, where we are talking about the correlation between sexual fantasy and actual behavior. So if someone has a fantasy, a vor fetish, a cannibalistic fantasy, or some other fantasy that they might engage in, that if they acted out would be a crime, what's the association between fantasizing and actually committing the crime? And my general approach, which of course isn't always applicable to every human being, is that fantasies are over-stigmatized and over-assumed to be associated with actual behavior. But Umberto was not necessarily disagreeing with that, but was providing the caution of, do we really want to allow people to have these kinds of dangerous fantasies when it might be one of those individuals that they might go down a road of actually committing these horrendous crimes?
I was specifically saying, you know, because you can't like not allow brain things to happen. It was more like, you know, if that's happening, that's something I would think you should do something about. Mm-hmm. Like you should seek help instead of keep fantasizing about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I, after the episode, thought, well, maybe because we do get into this debate sometimes, me and you, we could actually do a follow-up episode. And I thought, because I'm often trying to tell you, Berto, the research. I'm trying to share with you psychological research. And I thought maybe it'd be good if you actually looked it up so you could be convinced either way yourself. Also, I thought it's been a while since I've looked into this and I haven't looked in specifically into vor fantasy and its association with actual behavior. Vor fantasy meaning typically what this involves is someone is fantasizing or engaging in talk during sex, role play, if you will, that they are either inside someone else's belly or they are having someone else inside their belly. There's various different manifestations of this. And we talked about that during both episodes in which we talked about Armie Hammer. A lot of it is extremely innocuous and fine, but scary to individuals. But anyway, so I tasked Umberto with looking up the research and presenting. And I'm open to being wrong because that is the scientific way. So let's get into it. What do you say, Berto?
Let's do it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor.
My name is Umberto Castaneda, and I make knobs that don't turn very well.
So present the research, Umberto.
Yeah. So first, let me start by saying that there's almost no research. Vor is not studied very much. Paraphilic disorders in general are understudied. Part of it is that, you know, they're not very common. And, you know, by percentage of population. So there's not a lot of resourcing that goes into it. And vor specifically is a subset of a subset. And so it doesn't get a lot. A few things to lay the groundwork. Vor is, the full name is vorarophilia. And it is essentially where, like you were saying, there's a fantasy there about either consuming or being consumed by. And there's an erotic association with that. There are different types, as you were saying as well. Some of them, what's called soft core vor, which is more of like just that, I just want to be inside of you, or I want you inside of me, that kind of thing. But it goes all the way to hardcore, which is more of like, no, I want to dismember you and like chew on you and eat you and all these things. A lot of the vor community is actually made up of folks that are into the softcore side. That's the majority. And there seems to be an actual negative connotation among that community with chewing. Like that seems to be a thing that they explicitly try to stay away from, which is interesting.
What do you mean?
Like what's because the chewing part is considered part of the more aggressive side of the fence.
Meaning that they're like, hey, in this community, let's not talk about the chewing because it's potentially going down a road of actual violence.
Yeah, I don't know that they explicitly laid down those ground rules. It just seems to be that the vast majority of the art, the conversations, the fantasizing is about the consumption, like the whole consumption. Imagine how a snake consumes, right? That's just like takes the whole body in, not the destruction or chewing or dismemberment, right?
The breaking apart of the, yeah, right. a common pornographic drawing in the vor community would be if you're a heterosexual man, you would have a beautiful, voluptuous woman and inside of her belly, and you can see inside like a cartoon.
That's right.
A naked man who is fully alive and able to breathe and will survive, but he's fully encompassed by, he has been consumed, and the woman is satisfied with the meal, but she doesn't rip apart the body and eat the man. It's more like when the big bad wolf ate Little Red Riding Hood. You know, eventually the person will emerge from the creature or the human.
And so this seems to be, like I said, the vast majority of the content. And and even there is tons of variation. There are fantasies about giantesses consuming, or other types of animals, dinosaurs, things like this. But again, really with that emphasis on the body is kept whole. There's the person is alive inside of the other person. But Hardvor is really about the physical injury, the chewing, the dismemberment, the digestion, the, you know, all those aspects. And that one seems not to be as common. There's other variants of Vor. There's same size Vor, which is like equal or equivalent sized creatures devouring each other. There's macro, which is where one of the devouring creature is much, much larger. In this case, like a giantess, for example, or a dinosaur, Godzilla, those kind of things. And then there's other variants. There's some cases where it's like microscopic. So like, think of, what was that? The Fantastic Voyage, or, you know, like you get shrunk really, really little, and then you go into the body, those kind of things. Vor is actually not in the DSM-5, at least the latest revision, explicitly. So it would be categorized as a fetishistic disorder, which is a subset of paraphilic disorder, if it were looked at as a disorder.
Meaning if it caused problems.
If it caused problems, that's right. But it's not explicitly exemplified. Like, I read through all of the fetishistic list, and it would land in there based on the descriptions, but they don't call out, oh, and for example, fantasies about eating and dismembering. Like, they don't go into that. The other thing that I found really odd is the most commonly cited paper about Vor is this case study in masochism and erotic consumption. And it is, you know, every time you do the searches, this case study keeps coming up over and over. So a couple things to be aware of. The term Vor, although the idea of cannibalism, consumption, is a very, very ancient idea. You know, you can go back to Greek myths, and obviously even before that, in the Bible, there's the whale consuming Jonas, and there's lots of Greek myths that involve one god devouring the other god, and in those cases, those gods are actually still alive in the other god's stomach, and eventually one god frees the other god. So like, these were ancient things that humans are already thinking about, not necessarily in a sexual way, but
yeah. Well, who knows, really? I mean, what the originators of these myths were thinking. But if I remember right, Zeus/Jupiter, his father, which I think was Cronos or Saturn,
Saturn's the Roman version,
right? Yeah. The father had heard a premonition or a prophecy that one of his children would smite him somehow, and he, as a result, ate all of his children, but Zeus/Jupiter was whisked away and protected from him. And so when Zeus/Jupiter grew up to power, he overtook his father and cut his brothers and sisters out of his father's belly. Yeah.
Right. However, the term Vor seems to have originated during the 1990s as an outcrop of the internet culture. So, and a lot of association to furry culture and, you know, sort of like fetishistic kind of culture.
Meaning that in all likelihood, people had these fetishes, but didn't necessarily have a lot of venues to discuss it or to get images around this, because it is a fairly rare fetish. But when the internet comes out, then you can, you know, band together and validate each other and find pornography around these. And it's usually drawings, correct me if I'm wrong.
Absolutely, yeah. And that the terminology didn't really exist. It might have existed underground or whatever, but there's no library of books that talk about it. You know, it wasn't really a publicized thing.
Yeah, Vor fetish has a ring of new internet to it, you know. I don't know that, but I always assumed it emerged similar with furry. We imagine that there were probably proto furries in the 50s, but they didn't call themselves furries, right?
Right. So when we're talking about disorders, as you mentioned, you know, the real thing is that does it cause harm to self or others? When the DSM talks about fetishistic disorders, it does mention that they're more reported in men. Again, this is not explicitly about vor. It is fetishistic disorders where, based on everything that I was reading, vor would probably end up landing. So fetishistic behaviors have been more reported in men, but also occur in women. And the difference is smaller for fetishistic fantasy than actual fetishistic behavior. So that's interesting. The fantasy part seems to be more equivalent between the sexes, but the behavior seems to be skewed, according to the DSM, slightly towards men.
Meaning for fetishes in general.
For fetishistic disorder. Fetishistic
in general,
disorder.
Yeah. Yeah. And we, again, want to delineate the research is looking at people who have problems, and within the fetishistic disorders are things like where you want to rub up against someone in the subway. That sort of thing. And obviously that causes harm. It's a crime. It's traumatic for people. And so that's a problem. And the other sort of fetishes that are still included in the DSM are cross-dressing, this kind of thing. And of course, you and I did a whole deep dive on the ridiculous nature of the way that it's laid out in the DSM and how it furthers shame of fetishes. And how people can have a fetish, say they have a vor fetish, and they never have, never will, don't want to actually harm another human being. They want to engage in consensual vor role play or fantasy. And yet they experience a lot of discomfort about their vor fetish because it's so stigmatized. And there's sex in general is stigmatized, but particularly something like this that isn't well understood and talked about. And thus the individual has a lot of distress and thus would qualify for a fetishistic disorder, a paraphilic disorder, because they have this, they meet the criteria for something that's out of the norm, which again is like, how do you define that? And it's causing distress. And it's like, well, the stress is from, it, according to that definition, being gay is a paraphilic disorder and used to be considered a sexual disorder. But we all understand now that the suffering for gay people has nothing to do with being gay and has everything to do with society. Having said that, rolling back to rubbing up against people in the subway, even if the individual doesn't have stigma around it, it's inherently harmful to other human beings. So thus, it is considered a disorder. So I just want to lay that out. And so the research around that regarding gender and prevalence is fraught with all that silliness of, are we really measuring people that have a disorder or people that report the fetish and also experience the stigmatization? Because you could absolutely have a vor fetish and have it be a legit problem independent of stigma, right? Where you are harming other human beings or you're overly obsessive about this or you, I don't know, or just completely ruining your life because this is all you want to do. Obviously, if you're harming other people, like you're literally, like with the allegations against Armie Hammer, one could argue that that's what, it's one way to frame it, right? Is that he had a vor fetish and he doesn't have empathy or is sadistic, allegedly. And thus, his vor fetish is absolutely a disorder because it's actually harming other people. He's carving into other people. He's making threats. It's non-consensual. He's not talking with other women who are into vor fetish role play, and thus it's a disorder. So, you know, the data is hard to find, one, and two, of the data, it's hard to interpret based on all the things I was saying.
Right. So now I was mentioning this case study that is the most commonly cited paper whenever you look around for information, like actual clinical studies about vor. But it's, if you read through it, and I sadly read through it, it's very disturbing because the individual it is about, the fact that it includes aspects of vor fetish is like one bullet point among a ton of problems that this individual has, including the fact that he's an offending pedophile and he has lots and lots of problems in his life and in his mind. So this isn't a case study of like someone who has some, you know, furry fantasies about consuming whole a person in a bunny rabbit. And no, this is, and so unfortunately, this provides very little insight into either the vor community or whether someone would offend or not. It just happens to be
right
that yes, among this individual in this case studies issues is this obsession with consumption and,
interesting. Yeah.
And cannibalism.
And just a side note on this, when I was first developing my dissertation years ago, I was thinking about doing my dissertation on individuals who are customers of online live webcam, pornographic webcam, I don't know the language, but where you pay by the minute to interact camera to camera with a sex worker, a model, a performer, this kind of thing. Mm. And I had come to realize that it was a new emerging area on the internet because of high-speed internet during the aughts, and thought someone should do some research on this. What's going on? And the question that I initially had was, who considers this to be cheating? Because in the past, people generally, if they knew their partner was looking at pornography and or masturbation or fantasizing, generally speaking, a lot of people, according to statistics, don't consider that to be cheating, as if they are actually engaging in a sexual act with another person. And so now, of course, there's variability. But when it comes to this, you're actually interacting live with a real person, but they're a performer. So how do you categorize? It seems like it's right in the middle. And what I wanted to know was, are people considering this to be cheating? Because I feel like, because I was actually running into this with my couples at times. There were couples that would come in and this would be either the main issue or other issues. And I felt like there wasn't research or awareness out there. Because one of the things that people should know before they engage in this is, just because it feels like regular pornography, it's on the computer and you're looking at video or images or something, to your partner, it could be very different and could completely ruin your marriage. And you should be aware of that and take that into account, check in with your partner before doing that sort of thing. So there's also money exchange. It's not just free viewing of things. You could conceivably have an ongoing relationship with a performer online that happens every day. So I wanted to do research on it, and I started to float this idea. And I don't know, even if I got encouragement, I don't know if I ever would have gone through with it, because I was just brainstorming, but I was, you know, workshopping it around with some mentors. And most of them were like, well, Kirk, you probably shouldn't do that, because you're kind of advertising the sort of person that you are by the topic of your dissertation.
What?
Yeah. And I was like, what, really? And they're like, well, you know, it's not explicit, but people will assume that you're into that. And I'm thinking, well,
what?
One, I'm not. And two, who cares if I am?
Who cares? And what a weird conception. Like, researchers can only study things that they're not into explicitly.
Yeah. But it's really a common thing that you will find, particularly a dissertation, that will absolutely seemingly be connected to the person's life. So, you know, like, it's not uncommon to have a dissertation like, you know, the effect of being a second daughter in a family that travels due to one of the parents being in the military and one of the younger siblings is autistic. You know, like, no joke, that will be the title of a dissertation. And you'll say, like, wow, that sounds oddly specific, you know? and a lot of times in the dissertation, they'll disclose in the introduction.
Like, this is me, and I was interested in learning if there was some general thing here.
Yeah. And so I learned that there's this stigma around that. And the people I was conferring with were pretty liberal, pretty open-minded around sexuality and stuff. But, you know, yet... there was this concern, you know, also because I was emerging within academia. I had been in academia for a while, but I was, you know, especially with one mentor, he was really trying to shepherd me into being program director and being like a big shot at the university, which he succeeded in doing eventually. But he was worried that if I come out with this dissertation, it would maybe, you know, cause some concern within the community or something. And so
it's so weird.
So imagine if you live in a more conservative town, a more conservative institution than Antioch, there would be more barriers. And thus, that's one of the factors as to why there's so little research in this area. That's my sidebar on that.
That makes sense. Well, because I was sort of surprised that, being that it is such a taboo, speaking of taboo, like there was this ranking of fetishes and how taboo they are. And, you know, vor was near, they ranked, the y-axis was reported sexual interest. So the higher it is, the more it's reported as a sexual interest, the lower it is, the rarer it is reported as a sexual interest. And the x-axis was taboo-ness. How taboo is it? And of course, vor was right there at the bottom right. Can you guess a few others that were at the bottom right, very close to vor?
Well, being attracted to minors, I'm guessing.
Pedophilia.
Yeah.
What else?
Murder? Rape?
You know, that one was not as low, not as far, just a little disturbing, but necrophilia was.
Ah.
And then bestiality. So, But anyway, so the point is, it's right up there with all those, right? Like it's, and it makes sense. So here's the deal. I did some other research that wasn't specifically about vor, because again, there's not a lot of research about vor, about sexual fantasies and violence, to see if, well, what do we know? Again, unfortunately, not a ton of research, but I did find a couple of papers. One of them from PubMed. I can send you a link later if you want to include it. But
well, let's take a break, Berto, and we'll get back.
Let's take a break.
Let's do it. What do you say?
Let's do it.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a new year, so of course it's time for New Year's resolutions. But often, those are just manifestations of internalized harmful voices, voices that tell us we're not good enough. So instead of making a resolution to change something, let's recognize that we are already good enough. Now, most people think of therapy as a place for us to work on our problems, but there are several schools of thought within the field of psychotherapy that adamantly reject that paradigm, like narrative therapy and solution-focused. Instead, these clinicians help us focus on what we're already doing well. And by helping us do that, data shows that we often will gravitate towards more beneficial patterns. Well, one place you can find such therapists is on BetterHelp. If you're thinking of starting therapy, it's definitely worth giving a try. So, celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit betterhelp.com/Kirk today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/Kirk.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right, we're back from the break. Continue, host Berto.
Yeah, so this article is aggression-related sexual fantasies, prevalence rates. And they literally researched, okay, so this term ASF, aggressive sexual fantasies. They wanted to see if there was any correlation between that and it being a risk factor to actual, you know, aggression and violent acts, illegal acts, things like that.
Which, by the way, you could argue that certain sections, some subcategories of vor fetish, are not actually aggressive.
Yeah,
particularly totally. to the individuals describing it, they'd be like, "No, it has to do with this weird fantasy about just being completely engulfed and inside another human being. I don't want to be like chewed up or even non-consensually swallowed. It's more of just wanting to be fully held by another. So it doesn't involve aggression at all.
Yeah. You mentioned during the last Armie Hammer episode, at one point you said something along the lines of, it was very brief, but you said something like, I'm not even sure if he qualifies as a vor fetishist, you know? And the thing is, yes, some of the things he said and said he wanted to do probably do qualify as what they call hard vor, because he was like, I want to cut you. I want to eat you, right? Like, yeah. That.
I want to cut, he said, I think he even said a text, I want to cut a rib out of you, he's saying to a woman that he's dating, and cook it and eat it.
That's So technically that does qualify. However, certainly that's not the majority of this community, right? So therefore, when we're saying,
meaning that because it's non-consensual, he's not engaging in consensual vor play.
100%. So the majority of the vor community is not aggression related. 100% not aggression related. It's, hey, you and I, we have a thing. I want to imagine that I'm this big giant and I consume you. Like, now, we might find it odd, whatever, but it's not, I want to hunt you down, see you suffer and kill you. You know, like, none of that, right? But where it does come to aggression related sexual fantasies, this is what the article or what the paper was studying. They were trying to basically see, it wasn't trying to find like a conclusive proof. It was just trying to see if they could use ASF, aggressive sexual fantasies, as some sort of predictor or as something to watch. Basically, kind of the question I was asking. To fast forward to the results, ASF may be an important risk factor for sexual aggression and should be more strongly considered. So even in this study, the result is like, yeah, maybe.
What was the method? I'm curious.
Yeah, so they did 664 participants in Germany, so it's localized. 77% were women, 23% were men. They were 21 to 27 years, and they answered an online questionnaire. They were mainly students. So, you know, you brought this up before. Like, we always just study students. They're always in a demographic.
In Germany. Well, they're usually in the Northeast United States, but...
Right. This one happened to be in Germany.
But, yeah.
So, yeah, there's another big limitation that they point out. They say the strength of the present study is that it's a large pool. It is large. And there were a lot of women there, which is good because it's usually... can have some issues with the number of representation of women. However, it was cross-sectional data, and it basically, you know, it was this online questionnaire, right? So there's limits. And what you really would want is sort of impossible to do, which is track, you know, tons of people's fantasies and then track to see if they offend and then correlate that back. And it's...
Right. It depends. It's really hard to these do. Studies... almost always depend on self-report. So the person has to self-report fantasy and they have to self-report intention or actual behavior. So I'm guessing the questionnaire was, do you have any of these aggressive, maybe they wouldn't use that term, but you know, do you have rape fantasy? Do you have, you know, sadistic sexual fantasy, this kind of stuff? And then they probably had another series of questions of, have you engaged in any of these behaviors, or do you actually want to engage in these behaviors? And what they found, that according to self-report of these individuals, that there wasn't a strong correlation between the fantasy and the intention or the committing of those behaviors. But according to the data, it might be.
Yeah. Basically, they compared it as a predictor compared to other risk factors like general aggression, psychopathic traits, rape myth acceptance, and violent pornography consumption. Compared to those others, ASF was the strongest predictor.
Interesting.
So, you know, again,
interesting. So, among all those factors, I thought it'd be the other way around based on what you're saying earlier. So, when you ask, and again, self-report, and there's probably a short little questionnaire section where you're assessing psychopathy, because you don't ask a person, are you a psychopath?
Probably
you're
just like, you know, because they say psychopathic traits.
Right. You're saying, how much empathy do you have? Or do you ever find that people accuse you of not having a lot of empathy? That sort of, do you find yourself accidentally harming people or blah, blah, blah? There's certain questions you can ask people on these surveys. And then you also ask people about general aggression, like how, you know, independent of sexual fantasy or behavior, how often are you aggressive or angry or hostile or violent or something? So you ask all these questions. And what I thought you would say is the psychopathy and the aggression would be more predictive of enacting these aggressive sexual fantasies. But you're saying that the fact that you just have the fantasies is more of a more likely or among the factors that predict the actual behavior, being a psychopath is lower on the list than actually have, which I guess makes some sense because if you're a psychopath.
I actually was going to say, this actually jives well with stuff you've said before. As an example, you've had a couple episodes with non-offending, non-offending pedophiles.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Minor attracted people.
Minor attracted,
they,
right.
They
okay.
call themselves, yeah.
Yeah, minor attracted. This was my intuition, like, and also from my own experience. We've talked about this in the past too. Like, I think the more someone obsesses with whatever it is, the more your brain is occupied with that thing. So what I think is if you already do have psychopathic traits, general aggression, right, all these kinds of things, and you are fantasizing a ton about doing things that are going to harm others, I'm just guessing that your brain, by some percentage amount, is slightly more inclined to like go and try to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no definitive proof. This is one study, but it does show some prediction capability of this thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing I found...
Before you go on to that.
Oh, yeah.
Before I forget, the other thing that we want to say, which is often left out of the conversation entirely, is if you provide people with enough treatment and support in a place where they can actually talk about their impulses.
Exactly.
And maybe even a sublimation, an acceptable path where they can actually get their needs met along these lines, or at the very least, a way to talk about how they can refrain from these behaviors, then you see a sharp drop off in the likelihood that people will take action. I just did an episode with a specialist in someone who treats sexual offending individuals, or people who have the potential, or people who have actually committed these crimes and have been court mandated into treatment. And what she was saying was the vast majority of her clients, when she actually provides them with treatment and provides them with support and provides them with a way of being able to bring it up, like, hey, I feel like I'm kind of going down a road, or hey, I am actually suffering generally in my life and I'm funneling all my pain into this obsession with harming children or something. And what she found was that when most of the clients are provided with attachments and emotional regulation and that sort of thing, they are much less likely to recidivate, you know, because they have all those data, right? And
yeah.
they're monitored over time because they've been found to commit that crime. And so when it comes to sexual aggressive fantasies, if these individuals are able to get their needs met, if they have proper treatment, if their attachment needs are being met, if they can talk about these impulses, in all likelihood, the likelihood of them committing these crimes is drastically less.
Totally. It's just sad that it's like so backwards. But okay, so the last bit I found, this was a really interesting and I think really good article. And granted, I'm not no expert, but just the fact is it was really well explained, summarized, tons of graphs, you know, excellent explanation of how they did the research and everything. And it's also done in Germany. So apparently Germany, because it's funded by the government too. So apparently in Germany, they might care a little more about these topics.
Well, and they have a lot less puritanical Victorian stigma around talking about sexuality. And thus their researchers have fewer barriers to actually getting these projects off the ground. And imagine the United States government funding a study around VOR and what kind of political suicide that would be for a politician that would support such a thing. I mean, we live in such a backwards country in that way.
I can't
so
see it.
We depend on other communities like Germany and Sweden, these other places to actually conduct this research.
So this is our sex drive and hypersexuality associated with pedophilic interest and child sexual abuse in a male community sample. So it was
say that one again.
Yeah. Our sex drive and hypersexuality associated with pedophilic interest and child sexual abuse in a male community sample.
Huh.
So it's much broader than just fantasies, but it includes a section about fantasies. They were trying to look at a lot of different, you know, factors that could or could not contribute to pedophilic interest and child sexual abuse. This was a large, you know, what was it? This was a large study of 17,000 almost 18,000 men over the age of 18. Now, unfortunately, this was also an online study, so there's still limits there. But
now, I will say a benefit of an online study is the potential chance of honest responses might go up because they are protected. They're at home. They're taking the survey, and they're not in a lab while the researcher is watching them, and you know, you're handing this survey over to them, and there could be this worry that, well, they're going to look at those responses and they'll know who I am. And so there might be a greater chance of honesty.
So there were a lot of findings in the study, but the one that I wanted to focus on, because it relates to our question, is actually really interesting, because I think it talks a little bit about what both of us have been saying from different sides. And this is, and they graphed it out, probability of contact child sexual abuse. And so the y-axis is the how probable it is that they will sexually abuse a child. The x-axis is how many fantasies they have of children. So low to high sexual fantasies of children. But they graph two different populations. One population is low antisociality population, and the other one is high antisociality population.
Which is another term for psychopathy.
Psychopathy. So like in the last study we talked about, they tried to assess for psychopathic traits. They did the same thing here. And what's very interesting is the graph for the low antisociality is kind of flat. It only dips slightly up towards the right side of high sexual fantasies, but it's mostly flat.
Meaning that for the non-psychopathic individuals that are attracted to children sexually, the more or less fantasizing they engage in, and because this is getting to difference. What we were debating,
right,
is that if you are actively encouraging your fantasies about sexuality with children, maybe masturbating at the same time, there is a very slight increase in the chance that you will actually commit a crime and harm a child. Whereas if you're a psychopath,
it is an exponential curve to the right.
Interesting. So if you engage in, if you're a psychopath and you engage in active fantasizing, then the chance of actually committing a crime exponentially increases.
Yeah, and it kind of makes this sense in this, you know, like what does a psychopath have? They lack the empathy, and they will try to just live a life that is, you know, what they're doing. But if their brain is obsessing constantly about something, and they don't care about the consequences of doing that something, then to me, intuitively, it makes some sense that they'll probably just do that thing that they're obsessing about.
Mm-hmm. Whereas for the non-psychopaths, even if they're fantasizing often every day, they still care about other human beings, and are, when they think about actually committing these acts, they're like, well, but I don't want to harm another human being. Right. That isn't to say that that doesn't happen, but it's far less likely than if you don't care about other human beings.
Right.
So the thing we want to control for, obviously, assess for is psychopathy.
So where I net out on this is still, you know, and mostly for myself, just because I've found this over the years, that I used to let my mind really fantasize without restriction. And
you were militant about that.
Yeah, you and I got into a big debate.
Yeah, one of our epic fights, perhaps our biggest fight, really, I don't know how long ago it was, like 12 years ago.
15 years ago.
was about this very thing.
Yeah.
That you were like, what? You cannot control my mind. Yeah, you cannot control. Well, you were saying, you cannot tell me what I can and cannot think about.
Right. And, you know, there's a part of that that's true. Like, you know, one human can't, you know, tell another human.
Right. And you know, we won't go into specifics, something. But my where I landed was, I'm not telling you have to. I'm just asking as a friend that you XYZ.
Right. And so then what I realized, not in that moment, but over the years, is, okay. And is this realization wasn't even just about this. It was about video games. It was about influences from movies. It was a lot of things. One example is when I used to love horror movies that were super violent and gory. When I had my first child, I was sitting there trying to watch Human Centipede 2, and I couldn't. Because just the thought that my child could be one of the victims, you know, was enough for me to not be able to do it anymore. And then I thought, okay, so clearly my brain is not immune to stimulus. Like, you know, I always had this conception, like, I can watch or see whatever, and I am immune to its effects if I choose to, right? But it's not That's not the way the brain works. So therefore, I've concluded that if I am constantly obsessing about something, and that something is maybe unhealthy or illegal or unethical or crosses a boundary, right? It's going to probably not be healthy for me. And so therefore, I should work actively to redirect my train of thought. Mm-hmm. Now, if I'm obsessing about, oh, I really want to finish this thing that I'm working hard on, okay, great, you know, that's fine.
Well, what led you originally to be militant about drawing a boundary and saying, you can't tell me what I can and cannot think about?
I think it was just that thought, like, that there's this inviolable barrier between fantasy and reality.
I know,
reality.
But had you experienced some argument where you felt like someone was being too invasive about that, like they were punishing you for having an innocent thought? That was the impression I had.
I don't know. Maybe it had something to... I honestly have no idea. If I were guessing, it might have something to do with my relationship with religion and leaving religion. Because so much of that is about what you should think. And if you think about what prayer is, like, it's supposed to be this thing, this like secret conversation with you and a God. And you know, a lot of Catholic guilt in Colombia and stuff, it was about what you shouldn't be thinking, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but I'm thinking maybe.
I mean, it sounds like a good candidate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So then you had a pendulum swing to.
Yeah.
No one can tell me what to think ever, 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 regardless of the circumstance. Then you and I have in that fight. And not only
no one should tell me what to think, because that sentiment I still sort of think is right. But I don't care what I think. And I will think whatever I think as much as I think it, period.
Yeah.
And there's regardless no consequence from doing that.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but after we made up... you maybe rethought that stance a little bit.
But it wasn't immediate. It took a while, but yes.
Yeah. And also with having children, you started thinking, oh, well, was the conclusion, I wonder what's going on in other, like when people do have kids and they still engage in this active fantasy about gore and harm and sexual harm, what was going on for you about that?
So I think that there are two different aspects, because one of them was the, just quite specifically, should I be able to obsessively fantasize about a woman, no matter who they are, in any context, right? And I really did have that kind of stance in my brain. I was like, yeah, that's fine. And after a while, I thought, okay, actually, I don't know if that's, just even for me, I don't know if that's healthy, like, because what's my goal here? Like,
right. I mean, a common question that emerges, and I think it is an interesting question. I don't think it's super cut and dry, is say you have a coworker yourself, Berto, and gender does play a role in this because women are often exploited by men in various
ways. And I have a lot of female coworkers because like when you're placing the little knobs, like women really coordinate it. Like I actually have a hard time.
Okay. And so you... might have an attractive coworker and maybe have an urge to engage in sexual fantasy while masturbating about this individual at work. And is that okay? Is that ethical? Right. One, two, what about your wife, right? Is it ethical to your wife to do that? And if you never tell your coworker, is that ethical or is it unethical even if you don't ever tell them? And to what extent, right? Maybe they're one of 50 images that runs through your mind, or are you, what's your stance on that?
Yeah, like where I've landed is that in general, any obsession, any constant obsession about a person or a topic that's not necessarily conducive, I've worked at actually actively suppressing that and moving on.
Why?
So that... because I just feel that it starts feeling unhealthy for me. Well, as an example, just to take a different topic, like with video games, this has happened to me in the past where I was not age four. Age four, actually, I think we pace it. But there was this video game many years ago that was an online, massively multiplayer game. It wasn't WoW. It was before that.
Oh, so people know age four. I thought you literally meant when you were 4 years old. So Age of Empires 4.
Age of Empires 4. Yeah,
is a game that me and Umberto obsessively play with his brother almost every night. And we have a lot of emotional ups and downs. Like our mood for the week depends on how things go in these games.
But so I
so that obsession, totally fine.
Totally fine.
Nothing pathological.
I played this game for a month straight. And when I mean a month straight, is I barely slept that month. Like, I would get 2 hours of sleep here or there, and I just play and play. And everything started suffering. My relationship. I took a month off from work. I was just, I mean, I told them, but it was still like a whole month. And I was just playing this game. That's all I was doing. I was barely surviving.
So along these lines, in the beginning of the slippery slope, you were at a crossroads where you're like, should I go down this road and
right.
think about this all the time? And you decided yes.
And I've been there. What's the harm?
I've been there too, not to that extent, but I'll be really into a game and I'll be like falling asleep thinking yeah. about like a build in the new Dungeons and Dragons or Divinity game. You know, I'm just like, okay, what if I made a character? Was like, and sometimes that's fun because I'm just like, right. oh, I've actually at the age of 51 found a video game that I'm actually into. That it feels sure. fun to kind of have that feeling again. But what if it's interfering with my life and right. I'm, right. It feels good to do that, but it's ultimately destructive. And so you started to, I'm guessing what you're saying is incorporating that credo,
exactly.
that principle into other areas of your life.
And I found that with horror movies. Now, the horror movies I still love and enjoy are kind of like the sillier ones. Things like Saw, the Saw series. But there's a genre of horror movies that are, that their whole point is to be super realistic and shocking.
Are there Rob Zombie movies like that?
No, worse than that. Worse than that.
Like
there are
what?
These movies like that are like, you know, the Cannibal Holocaust and worse, there's worse. And I used to...
So these are like underground horror movies that I wouldn't have heard about?
15 years ago, I printed out a list and I sent it to my friend and I was like, hey, these are the movies we got to watch. I bought several of them and I started realizing, wait, like, I don't know if these things actually don't affect me. And I don't know if I want to keep going down this road. Like,
even before you had kids?
Yeah. And then when I had kids, it was over. It was like...
How was it affecting you before you had kids?
Because like some of these movies cross the line to that, yeah, they're still fake, but what I'm watching might as well be real because it looks real. And these are people in incredible amounts of agony and torture and things. And
I mean, that's the point of these movies, right? It's horror movies for horror movie fanatics, right? Like,
yeah.
It's taking... But what outcomes does it have on your personality and your behavior?
That was what I was afraid of, is that it's not like anything actually happened to us. Like, oh my gosh, I almost killed that person because I watched it, you know. But I was afraid like it was turning this like dark page in my mind, you know. And maybe it would have been fine, you know.
What dark page? What was on the other page?
I just like always thinking about those things, you know.
Which would lead to what?
I don't know, but I kind of didn't want to find out. I didn't want to find out what would happen. Like, would I be, you know, depressed? Would I feel stressed? Would I feel that? Would I actually be more aggressive? Would I, like, accidentally lash out in some case? Like, I don't know, but I didn't want to find out.
Would you think of other humans as objects and meat?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Instead of actual feelings?
But again, I used to feel that I was invincible mentally and that I could watch anything and be completely unaffected. And just as I grew up, learned more, blah, 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 I was like, oh, yeah, no, that's not a thing. The brain's not like that. And so, in fact, the brain absorbs quite a lot of stuff. So that was it. So I still love, you know, silly horror movies and gore to some extent. But I totally stopped going down that road of like the more realistic, the really dark one. I was like, nah, I can't. And then when I had a child, even ones that were sort of middle of the road, I'm like, even that's a little too much. Because it just felt a little
saying,
too close for comfort.
Even children that were middle of the road, that's how it kind of followed in the sense.
Yeah, when I had children. But, okay, and so then bringing it back to like the sexual fantasies.
Well, let's take a break.
Oh,
when
yeah.
we get back, let's continue that. What do you say?
Let's do it.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a new year, so of course it's time for New Year's resolutions. But often, those are just manifestations of internalized harmful voices, voices that tell us we're not good enough. So instead of making a resolution to change something, let's recognize that we are already good enough. Now, most people think of therapy as a place for us to work on our problems,
But there are several schools of thought within the field of psychotherapy that adamantly reject that paradigm, like narrative therapy and solution-focused. Instead, these clinicians help us focus on what we're already doing well. And by helping us do that, data shows that we often will gravitate towards more beneficial patterns. Well, one place you can find such therapists is on BetterHelp. If you're thinking of starting therapy, it's definitely worth giving a try. So, celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit betterhelp.com/Kirk today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/Kirk.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So bringing it back to the sexual fantasies, I similarly found that, I decided that I didn't want to, I wanted to avoid having obsessive fantasies about any specific people because it just didn't feel, I don't know, comfortable and healthy anymore. Not because like, ooh, I might do something about it. Just more of like, I don't know. It just felt, if it didn't feel okay. It's sort of a personal decision.
Well,
but I gotta tell you,
I don't know if you want to cut this out, and I won't go into specifics, but could it have been at least unconsciously part of an overall shift in your life priorities to be more of a family man, to be more stable, to be more dependable and less erratic in your lifestyle?
I can imagine. But I do want to draw a distinction. It's that, look, I have, you know, without going into too much TMI, I have recurring sexual fantasies that I just recur because they're easy to like visualize and stuff. But what used to happen is like I would be at the gym or I would be at a store or something and I would see an attractive female and I would just like, my brain would just obsess. It's like, oh my gosh, that person is so attractive. Oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And then that's the thing that I started like, stop, just, you know, I know she's cute. Keep going. You know?
But and of course it could be at least partially fueled by your sexual abuse that you went through or just.
No, I think it was a lot of that in my mom leaving, which was, oh my gosh, woman must accept me.
Oh.
That woman, but you know, in my mind, it was not that. It was translated to like, attractive woman, attractive woman, attractive woman, attractive, you know.
Yeah. Interesting.
And so I, you know, part of it is just, you know, I was younger, probably like there's some biological components about triggering that response. But there was this aspect of obsession. And again, I never would do anything about it. Like, but just the fact that my mind just couldn't even focus on anything else. I remember being in class when I was in college, not being able to pay attention if there was a woman in my class that I found attractive. I was just like, just the whole time thinking about her.
Mm. Well, and, so if you were a client of mine, I would say that, and I would work on the awareness around this, that it's a barometer more than an actual impulse. It's a indication that you are lacking attachment security, you're lacking closeness or something. And so it's interesting and you note it, but you don't want to go down the explicit or the conscious route because it's actually not going to meet your needs. You want to be like, yeah. Oh, if I'm obsessing on this person in the Starbucks or whatever, or in class, I must be actually feeling kind of lonely. Maybe I should route my behavior towards building that, and thus I won't be doing these obsessive things, you know. And you describe it pretty well. It's one thing to see an attractive person and go like, ooh, you know, I'm going to entertain a little fantasy here while I'm not doing anything else. But you're saying you couldn't even concentrate on the class.
I couldn't think of anything else.
Yeah.
And it was this visceral, it wasn't just like a mental thing. It was like my whole body would just like get taken over. And I just thought it was natural. And then...
Right. And when I met you back in the day, you would claim, and maybe not even that long ago on the podcast, that it was testosterone. It was
because
the male way, you know?
Because I hate to say it, but more like probably 80% of my male friends who probably have their own terrible attachment problems seem to be very similar.
Yeah.
I was very shocked, by the way, when I would talk to you, because I was like, wait, you're not like that? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah. So I'll say two things. One is that it's probable that a lot of people, men included, are walking around with a lot of attachment injuries. And I've talked about this before, that the only attachment behavior that we allow men to engage in is sexual pursuing.
Right.
And they're not allowed to ask for hugs. They're not allowed to cry. They're not allowed to talk about their feelings. They're not allowed to go to therapy. They're not allowed to ask for support or validation or to have a sit down with someone and just talk about your one's feelings. But men are absolutely allowed to pursue. In fact, men can, in some communities, can just catcall women on the street. It's like normalized and also accepted. And if you don't do that as a man, you're not considered a real man. So it's like completely lopsided. So a lot of men will funnel all of their attachment needs into this one behavior and get some of their needs met, but not all for sure. Yeah. And thus they just continue to go down that road. And eventually they might even coerce and harm other people because they're so desperate for their needs to be met that they will pressure other people to do things that the other person doesn't want to do, isn't ready for it. So that's one perspective that will explain what you're talking about with you and some of the other people, you know. The other is that testosterone is associated with increased horniness.
Yeah, so that's absolutely
not that people with low testosterone can't be horny, but there are a lot of things involved in that. But when people do have an increase in testosterone for one reason or another, on average, of course, not everyone will report an increased level of rumination or obsession or intrusive thoughts about sexuality.
So where I net out, definitely for myself, and just if I were giving anyone advice, it would be like, hey, listen, if you have a pattern of obsessive thoughts that lead you down roads that either you don't feel like you can control or they have negative consequences or whatever, maybe work on that and learn to redirect it. Because it, like in the examples I've given, I was experiencing harm, you know, in different ways, but I was experiencing harm and others would experience harm as well. And as I've, been able to, nowadays, the way I do it is very simple. Like if I am at a grocery store and I see someone attractive, the thought happens before I even have a chance for it not to happen. But I actively just move on with my day. Hmm. And it feels actually more powerful. You know, it's like, oh, okay. My mind does not have to be solely occupied by this. I can go and buy the things I came to buy. It's crazy, but imagine.
And I would hope that you would also realize that, oh, maybe I'm feeling lonely or I deserve to take notice of other attachment needs that I have in my life that I been ignoring.
Actually, no. That is an interesting point you bring up. Now, what's odd is a lot of it would have been still, well, I still had many friends, a girlfriend, eventually a wife, kids, and yet it would still happen. And I think because none of those things were able to just replace my mom when I was little and take away the sexual abuse, right? So the only things that could help with that were the years of therapy, the processing of all that and things like that. But so you're right that clearly that behavior had to do with all those aspects. But unfortunately, it wasn't as simple as like, oh, I shouldn't think about that. I have friends, you know, because it's like, it was deeper than that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It was something I couldn't just like, oh, I shouldn't think about that. My mom can come back when I'm 3.
Yeah.
That couldn't happen. And I didn't even put those together, right? Like, I didn't know those dots were connected.
Does your wife know? And I.
Oh, yeah.
That you are refraining in this way?
Yeah, because so the other thing that used to happen is when we were young, whenever we'd be out and about and I would see an attractive female, I would obsessively, like I would tell her, oh my gosh, look how cute that person is. Like, don't you think she's cute? You know? And of course this would annoy her. And I'm like, no, I'm not saying you're not cute. I'm just like, I want someone to share with my obsession right now because I'm not actually going to go do anything about it. I just want you to acknowledge because I can't just live through this hell by myself. Not in those words, mm-hmm. but it was kind of what was happening.
Yeah, and it was in line with that previous mode you're in, which is all thoughts are okay. And
yes.
And no one can tell me what to and what not to think about.
And I thought there was a get out of jail free card for all of it, which was honesty, brutal honesty. Because I thought, look, as long as all my cards are on the table with my girlfriend at the time and eventually wife, it's like, what's the problem? Like, I'm being honest. And like, I still stand by honesty, but it's like, well, you don't just because you're like, yeah, I robbed your car. So yeah, I still robbed your car.
Right. And, you know, being a victim of sexual abuse where your feelings didn't matter and someone else exploited you, you know, she was, what, 12 and you were 5, is a modeling of behavior that says other people's feelings about it don't matter. And right. So it's okay to just bulldoze ahead because that's what the world is like. That's what people are like. That's what I learned is okay to do. And so why am I getting pushback from this person? I didn't know. I wasn't allowed to push back when I was 5. So my last question, Berto, is, am I right?
So I think that we both have aspects that are right because I think, man, look, you know, in the end,
one
conclusion is there's not enough data.
Yeah.
There's just not enough data. But from the data that is there, I do think there is some correlation for some individuals that if the more they obsess about stuff, the worse it can get. And one of the points I was trying to make was that in our last debate was that since you can't control, you know, for population, like there will be psychopaths among us, there will be, and you're just trying to give blanket advice to everyone, it doesn't help to say like, don't worry, fantasize away with the worst fantasies possible and you'll probably be fine because there's a small percentage that won't be. So that's why I was trying to be like more conservative and say, maybe let's curb our obsessive fantasies, especially if they are obsessive fantasies about like murder and dismemberment and things like that. So there's that. And then I think there is some data that shows that people that are not psychopathic with, in this case, at least with fantasies about children, like there's not a high correlation between the fantasies and the action. So, you know, I do think it's true that, to your point, that most people that are not psychopathic can probably indulge in fantasies and live a fine life, you know, and that's fine. And then to my point, if we're giving blanket advice, if we're telling the broad population, should you or should you not indulge in hyper-violent, destructive fantasies as much as you want at all times, my advice would be like, no, don't do it. Because there's at least some percentage of you that the more you obsess about it, you're going to do it. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. And then the other thing is, hey, should we or should we not criminalize what you're thinking? And that one's like, well, no, we can't and we shouldn't. Yeah. So,
yeah. And another thing you were getting at is the fantasy could actually be degrading your life in ways that aren't necessarily resulting in you committing the act, but could be causing you to have stress that you're not aware of, or dehumanization of other people, or eclipsing other kinds of fantasy that might be possible because this one, for whatever reason, you're just deciding to engage in. The other thing I'll say, in addition to your other points, which I absolutely appreciate, and the research that you presented is interesting to me, new to me. I don't know what I would have predicted in terms of the results of those studies, but I don't know if I would have predicted that. So that is good to know, and it is a good foundation for future conversations because we'll probably get into this in the future. So if you can, actually send me those studies so I can actually jot them down in my notes. But the other point that I want to make is that my push for destigmatization, because my big thing, regardless of the kink, is that we want to separate the association of the kink with the behavior, because so much of kink has nothing to do with the behavior, particularly the behavior that society will associate with that, right?
Right.
If someone's into BDSM, you know, average person in our society will assume, oh, well, you want to rape or harm or coerce or tie someone up involuntarily. And the BDSM person will say, no, it's like, I would never want to do that. I've never done that. BDSM is completely consensual. And it's a lot of play. Vor fetish, similarly, right? Especially when you consider the sort of manifestations of vor fetish, where they're looking at a cartoon of a giant wolf eating a naked man, you know, a giant wolf with boobs, you know, that is eating a naked man. Like, how do you even manifest that in real life? And so the amount of stigma on kinks in general, including vor fetish, is so harmful and so pervasive and such a problem that, generally speaking, if I don't have a lot of time to explain myself, I wanted to tell people it's okay. And there isn't an association, generally speaking, with those fantasies and actually acting them out. That's my big thing, because the amount of suffering, and by the way, according to the expert that I talked to that treats sexual offenders, is when you stigmatize a sort of thing, even the thoughts, people go underground and they won't reach out for help when they need it. They won't get their attachment needs because they're shaming themselves, and they don't, or when they do bring it up to their partner or it's revealed to their partner that they have these fantasies, their partners will reject them. The, you know, entire communities will, and then they have none of their attachment needs met. They fall into alcohol and drug abuse. They develop a lot of anger and hurt, and that's when they might actually commit some of these crimes. Not necessarily, but it raises the risk of that. So my big thing is destigmatization, divorcing the fantasy from the behavior, because that's an overall good. But I absolutely appreciate the point from the research that for those individuals who are engaging in that kink activity, fantasizing, and they're psychopathic, then yikes, no, do not engage in those thoughts unless you have a pretty elaborate system to prevent you from committing those acts, because you're at risk of committing those acts.
And that was what I was thinking as I was watching that documentary, is that in this particular individual's case, Armie Hammer's case, it's like, yeah, no, you're not just fantasizing about this. Like, you want to do these things. So stop. Mm-hmm. Like, no one's got consent, and these are deadly ideas. So don't.
And I want to revisit that just for a second and say that, generally speaking, I think it's not a good idea, even if the target never knows about it, to fantasize about them, especially if it's the sort of person that comes from a group of people that is often exploited anyway. Because, you know, you could argue, well, if they never find out, what's the big deal? But I don't know. There's so many other ways to fantasize, right? You can fantasize about an unnamed person, or fantasize about a paid performer who is doing it for that reason. You know, there are unquestionable ethical targets of one's fantasy, and there are questionable targets of one's fantasy. And thus, I think, why do that? if there's a, you know, now it's possible that the target would be neutral or even excited that your fantasy, you know, they're like, go for it. I'm open to that. But unless you know that, I don't know. It just feels like it's just putting something out there in your mind, into the universe, or something that is potentially harmful, particularly if the target eventually finds out, right? If you somehow, you know, let it sneak out or something, or it affects your behavior at work, you know, I could see that happening where you're just a little different with the person and they detect that. Like, that would be awful. And I'm guessing there are people out there who could share stories about that. It's just like, yeah, I had a coworker who I discovered had been fantasizing about me, and it felt extremely violating to me, and I was not comfortable with it. So I just say, you know, when in doubt, don't, because for all the reasons I just said. Anyway, and everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because
you deserve it.
With
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.